And we are back on KUCI's Justice or Just Us. It's a band called Tranquility Base, and the track is They Came in Peace, which is fitting because in December of 2005, a group of 24 friends following the nonviolent tradition of Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker Movement walked to Guantanamo Prison to visit the prisoners, calling themselves Witness Against Torture. When they returned, they launched the campaign to shut down Guantanamo, a campaign that consists of public education and community outreach, as well as networking and resource sharing, and acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, all to draw attention to the plight of prisoners in Guantanamo and the plight of victims of the war on terrorism everywhere. Here to talk about her journey to Guantanamo prison is Frida Berrigan. Frida Berrigan is a senior research associate with the Arms Trade Resource Center of the World Policy Institute. She's a graduate of Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. She's worked with a Central America Solidarity Organization for 2 years before coming to the World Policy Institute. She is also an all-around great person and kick-ass activist, and she joins us on the line from New York. Good morning, Frida.
Good morning, Jarrett.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well.
What's it like in New York right now?
Well, it's sunny and a little cool. Very California kind of weather.
Right now it is. It's quite, I'd say it's cold, but you'd probably laugh at a 55-degree morning. But well, thank you for joining us this morning. Tell us the story. How did you decide to take that journey to Guantanamo?
Sure. Well, throughout the last year, maybe beginning early last summer, a group of us began meeting, and really the question we were looking at and trying to answer together was, how do we resist the war on terrorism? How do we respond to the victims of the war on terrorism? And it was a pretty big question, and one area that we really focused on was Guantanamo, because as your listeners will remember, we know a lot about Guantanamo now, but it really was a building up of little pieces of information over the last four and a half years. So we were getting these little bits of news about Guantanamo, about the torture and abuse that men were suffering there, more and more information about who they were, that they weren't the worst of the worst, that they weren't terrorists, that many of them had just been caught up in sweeps in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Many of them had been sold. Bounties had been offered on their heads. They were caught up in grudges, and turning them over to the Americans was a way of removing, you know, people that you didn't like from your neighborhood.
It sounds like you're describing the Wild Wild West.
Right, and there's an element of that. I mean, people who are there say, well, you know, I had wanted to buy a piece of land, and I got outbid on the land, and I offered a higher bid, and then the next day I, you know, was being hauled away by the ISI, the Pakistani security forces, and my neighbor was able to buy the land. And he had, you know, given evidence against me, and, you know, that was the last my family ever heard from me. So, and then later in the summer, prisoners at Guantanamo began a hunger strike. And in the beginning, it was just 20 or 30 men who stopped eating. And that was a real turning point for this small group of us who had been meeting and trying to think about action to take. And that was a turning point because the prisoners directed their appeal directly to the American people. And they said, there's nothing we can do. You know, a few of us have lawyers, but the courts, the American justice system, is completely closed to us. And we've just been sitting here. We've been tortured, been held in these cold places. We've been stripped naked. We've been sexually humiliated. Our religion has been completely trampled on. And we've just been suffering, and we don't have a voice. And so we're going to use our bodies as our voice, and we're going to stop eating. And we appeal to the American people to respond to us. And it was as though they were talking directly to us. And we took that very, very seriously. Many of us began fasting on Fridays as a way of being in solidarity with the prisoners there. And we said, if Guantanamo were at Fort Dix or at Camp Pendleton or any place in the United States, we would be there. And we would be outside vigiling. We would be trying to go visit them. We would be in communication with their families. And Guantanamo is in Cuba, is in a country that it's illegal for Americans to travel to for a very cynical and insidious and conscientious reason, right, to hide it from the American people and to put it outside the scope of U.S. law and international law. So how do we get there kind of became the question that we were asking and the problem we were trying to solve. How do we go? And you know, once you're in community and breaking the law isn't such a scary thing anymore when you're with friends, it just didn't seem so difficult to fly to Cuba and break the embargo that the United States has against Cuba and to walk. Guantanamo, I don't know how much folks know about it. It's a bay. The Guantanamo Naval Base straddles the Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. It's on the eastern end of the island. It's thousands of hectares large. And the United States has held it since the turn of the last century, since 1903, 1906. It was one of the loot of the Spanish-American War. The United States got control of Guantanamo Bay. And we've been occupying it ever since. And it's really a little slice of the United States. They generate all their own power. Their water and food is all imported. Very few Cubans work on the base. I think just three at this point. It's mostly a Jamaican and Caribbean workforce that's there. And thousands of U.S. soldiers live there. There's a bowling alley. There's movie theaters. There's McDonald's and Starbucks. Right there on the edge of Cuba is this little slice of Middle America. But it's also, you know, a little slice of hell because, as we know, more than 1,000 men have cycled through Guantanamo. About 400 are imprisoned there now. And there they've been tortured and abused and held completely incommunicado. So in December, we finally got everything together and flew to Cuba. There were 24 of us, as you said in your introduction. Most of us are part of the extended Catholic worker community, and the mandate out of the Gospel of Michael, no, the Gospel of Matthew, to visit the prisoners, to clothe the sick, to perform works of mercy was very, very important. So this walk to visit the prisoners at Guantanamo was an extension, a real exercise of our faith and an extension of the work that so many Catholic workers do on a daily basis, to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the imprisoned. And so we began to walk. We arrived in Cuba on December 6th. On the 7th, we began walking, and we figured over the course of the next 5 days, we would arrive at the U.S. military base at Guantanamo. And there, we hoped that the gates would open and that we would be welcomed onto the base by U.S. military personnel and granted access to the prisoners there. And that didn't happen. We were stopped at a Cuban military fence that surrounds the U.S. base. And they said, we can't let you through unless the Americans, give you permission to get, onto their territory. So there at that Cuban military fence, which is really just kind of a cow fence, a couple of strips of barbed wire in a sort of flat plane moving towards the coast, we set up a vigil. And for 5 days we fasted and we prayed around the clock. We kept watch and we turned and oriented ourselves towards the prison itself. And we knew that we were about 5 miles from Camp X-Ray, Camp Delta, the other camps where men We're being held, we're being interrogated, we're being tortured, and we're starving themselves to death and trying to commit suicide because their life was completely intolerable, and that this is the only way for them to assert their humanity, assert control over their own lives. And we hoped that our prayer and our intention would cover the remaining distance that was between us and the prisoners there at Guantanamo. As we walked, we each of us sort of held in mind a prisoner at Guantanamo. We read the story of their imprisonment and the story of their lives over and over again from fact sheets from the Amnesty International website. I walked with a man named Murat Kurnaz, who has recently been released from Guantanamo and is back in Germany. He's of Turkish descent, but grew up in Germany and has just recently returned home. So I walked that whole we walked about 20 kilometers a day, walked in mindfulness, in solidarity with Murat Kurnaz. So we walked for long periods of silence and prayer. And sometimes we chatted. We marveled at the beauty of the Cuban countryside and interacted with people along the way who were all delighted and confused by what we were doing. They kept saying, hey, it's a long way to Guantanamo, and you're going to walk there? That's crazy. We found, and this was unintentional, that as we were walking to make this statement as Americans, as Christians, we were also walking on behalf of the Cuban people who are powerless to do anything about what's happening at Guantanamo, what's happening on their land, what's happening in complete violation of the treaties and agreements signed between the Cuban and the U.S. governments about what's supposed to happen at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station. They can't do anything about it except not cash the checks that the United States pays in rent to the Cuban government for occupying that vast area. So we carried the desires of the Cuban people with us, which was a real privilege. And then we arrived there. We arrived on Human Rights Day, International Human Rights Day, which is December 10th, and then we set up our vigil. We had liturgy every day. We fasted, as I said before, and we had a press conference. U.S.-based media, Reuters, Associated Press, came out from Havana, which is all the way on the other side of the country. And so we were able to speak to the international media. We were able to speak to U.S. officials through making these statements at the press conference. And again, we called the head of public relations and the command at the base at Guantanamo, asking for permission to enter the base. The base did issue a statement. They didn't let us on, of course, but they did issue a statement that said, we know that there are protesters. We have not seen them, and the base is functioning normally. And it struck us as we were vigiling and praying there, that there is nothing normal about torture. There is nothing normal about men who have been taken from their families, who have been hooded and shackled and flown halfway around the globe, who haven't seen their children or communicated with their families in almost 5 years, and been beaten and tortured and abused, that is normal, is a severe, severe problem.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners, they're tuned to KUCI in Irvine. This is Justice or Just Us. We're speaking with Frida Berrigan from Witness Against Torture, which is a campaign to shut down Guantanamo. If we could take a step back for a second, can you describe the context of this trip? You know, Americans have a very short memory. What specifically was going on in terms of the debate at the time you were there. When exactly did those suicides occur? Was that before you went or after you went? As well as the was this at or about the time when the controversy over the flushed Qurans took place? Exactly when, you know, did the trip take place in the broader context of some of the heated debates about Guantanamo? And did you get a sense that your trip maybe added to the debate?
Sure. Well, the suicides happened more recently. In June of this year, three men committed suicide. But all throughout the spring and summer of 2005, men were attempting suicide. So starting early in the year, right, in late 2004, we knew very little about what had happened at Guantanamo. Earlier in 2004, the Supreme Court ruled that U.S. Law extended to Guantanamo, and that those men who were being held there had access to the U.S. law. So that very important court case, the Razul case, had been completed in 2004. 2005, we learn about Abu Ghraib. We learn about the torture and abuse that's happening there. Those infamous images happened early in 2005. And then we have the head or one of the leaders at Abu Ghraib, military leaders, come to Guantanamo. And there's a great, or not great, but very informative, very long article in the New York Times Magazine a couple weeks ago about 2005 at Guantanamo, which is very interesting for people who want to learn more. Yes, early in 2005, we have the desecration of the Quran, repeated degradation of the holy book there, and we have a number of protests being launched by prisoners at Guantanamo to win better treatment and better conditions for the men being held there.
And it's sad that we need excuses to protest a place where people are being detained indefinitely. I mean, I don't mean to have that question suggest that people shouldn't be protesting, you know, the indefinite detainees if their religion was respected or things of that nature.
Right,
I mean,
right.
The whole thing is just kind of sick. But again, you know, it seems like the timing of your trip was unfortunately fortunate, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, it felt that way. And then in August, we have the beginning of this hunger strike and a move from, short hunger strikes aimed at getting better conditions to just a all-out, we're going to hunger strike until we die or are released. And what's interesting to note about those hunger strikes is that they were initiated by prisoners at Guantanamo who are from Europe, and specifically from England, and were directly linked to the IRA hunger strikes during the time when the Irish Republican Army was fighting the British Empire. Mm. And so Bobby Sands and the other men who fasted to the death in Long Kesh, the men in Guantanamo really saw themselves as a new generation of this kind of this kind of struggle, and linked again and again, linked themselves to those men who hunger struck to be recognized as political prisoners and not as sort of common criminals, is how they were being defined by the British justice system. So it was a rejection of the notion of enemy combatant, assertion of personhood, and it was simultaneously really desperate and profoundly courageous. And so So that began in early August. And then throughout the fall, we got more and more information about the hunger strikes. There was lawyers coming back from Guantanamo just devastated and traumatized by what they were seeing. And they had a lot more access to the media in the wake of the whole Abu Ghraib thing. And so we just felt like we were getting a lot more information about what was going on at Guantanamo. In October of last year, again before we left, a report came out about how force feedings how hunger strikers were being force fed, the violence with which they were being force fed, put in 4-point constraints, and huge tubes being shoved up their noses, the same tube being used on multiple prisoners, very fiber filled, food being essentially injected into their bodies, and then men sitting in their own excrement for hours in these 4-point constraints. So just the brutality was much more on display. We were getting more information about it.
One of the things that I think a lot of people who are, you know, part of the peace movement or the anti-war movement at least are curious about is whether the message is getting to the people that need to hear the message. And sometimes those people who need to hear the message aren't necessarily those in power, but the victims with whom, you know, we're ostensibly standing in solidarity. Did you get a sense of whether the detainees, or we should actually call them what they are, the prisoners, did they know that there was a protest going on?
Yes. Yes, as we met beforehand, we said, well, what, you know, we know we might not be able to actually get into the base, we might not be able to actually visit the prisoners. What does success mean? How would we be successful in doing this? And we thought, well, if we get media attention and we're able to tell the story, that would be great. And we listed a number of other things. And then somebody said, I just want the prisoners to know that we tried. And we're like, gosh, like, that's going to be really hard. But that's, yes. Like, that's what we want to have happen. And we thought, well, maybe if we're covered on Arab language press, it will sort of leak in. And anyway, that will maybe just our prayers will actually, you know, be picked up on by the prisoners. But in March, you know, we came back in December of 2005. In March of 2006, we got an email from Tom Wilner, who represents 12 Kuwaiti prisoners at Guantanamo. And he said he was in correspondence with one of our friends, you know, who was part of the trip. And he said, you know, I just want you to know that my guys knew you were there.
Wow.
And they knew you were there while you were there. They knew you were there in December. And they just want to say thank you. And you know, they say that email is a sort of not very good form of communication. But I got this email and I just wept, and it meant so much to all of us to know that we were there, and that we were there, but they knew we were there as Christians. They knew we had walked, and they knew that we were responding to the hunger strike. And I have no idea. We don't know how that message all got to them, and got to them exactly as we intended to communicate had we been able to sit down face-to-face with them. And since then, we've heard from other lawyers who have told us the same thing, that it kindled hope, that it reminded them that they were human beings and that other human beings were reaching out to them. We feel an incredible sense of responsibility, I guess, is the best way to put it at this point, having reached out, having made this connection, this incredible responsibility, to see that Guantanamo is shut down, to see that these men are tried and released, and that some effort is made to give them back their lives. How do you repay somebody for 5 years of their lives? How do you repay them after stripping them completely of their dignity and humanity? But some effort has to be made to repatriate them and reparate them for all they've lost.
Well, in the time we have left, let's talk about some of the campaigns that are going forward. Can you tell our listeners about the International Day to Shut Down Guantanamo?
Sure. January 11th will mark the fifth anniversary of quote-unquote war on terrorism prisoners being brought to Guantanamo. And so it's an important day. It's an important day to reflect on, you know, what have the last 5 years of your life looked like? What have you accomplished in the last 5 years? And make some connection to those men who have been wasting away in Guantanamo as we have gone about our lives. So many of us will be in Washington. We're hoping that hundreds of people will join us in Washington for a protest to shut down Guantanamo and to give these men back their lives and to challenge the Bush administration's ripping up of the Bill of Rights, ripping up of the Constitution, and ripping up the humanity and dignity of human beings, and just saying everybody's the worst of the worst, everybody's an unlawful enemy combatant, and trust us, we can do whatever we want here. And we're seeing the law just being tattered left and right recently with the passage of the Military Commissions Act and suspension of habeas corpus and all of that. So we'll be gathering in Washington and do a significant protest, and we hope that many people will join us. If people can't come to Washington, there's many opportunities to bring Guantanamo, bring some measure of the suffering and the humanity of the people who are there to street corners and town squares around the country. So we're asking people to hold vigils, to hold marches, to engage in public protest on this day. So there's more information about all of that at our website, which is www.witnesstorture.org. Again, that's www.witnesstorture, and that's one word, .org. And we hope to continue to update that and invite people to be in dialogue with us about ways to mark this very, very sad anniversary, and sad for the lives of those men and men around the world who are held in secret and indefinite detention, but also a sad day for the 300 million of us who live in this country that is called a democracy, where there is no freedom except, as we're told again and again by the administration, the freedom to be very, very afraid.
How important is it that the anti-war movement broaden its message to include things like shutting down Guantanamo? Because it seems as if the message of the anti-war movement is unfortunately simply that, an anti-war message, and it's actually an anti-Iraq war message. But, you know, we forget about Afghanistan, we forget about the Patriot Act, we forget about Guantanamo, and it's quite conceivable that the war in Iraq could come to an end while all of these, you know, legal and detention structures remain intact.
You raise such an important point there, Jared, that when we're anti-war, we really need to be against the war on terrorism as it's being waged, as it's being articulated, and that war is happening, as you said, in Afghanistan. It's happening in Iraq as the administration continues to link al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, al-Qaeda and all of the insurgent groups that are operating in Iraq. And it's happening on Bagram Air Base, where 500 men are being held. It's happening at Guantanamo, and it's happening here in the curtailment and rolling back of civil liberties and in this constant drumbeat of fear. And the only way that we're going to turn things around is through a strong assertion of the principles of American democracy, which are, you know, which are our freedom, engagement, the rule of law. This country has some of the best laws in the world, but they are constantly under attack by the institutions of power in this country. You know, Michael Ratner, who's the head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is sort of overseeing all of the legal battles around Guantanamo, says, you know, we can't win any of this in the courts, right? It's a slow, grinding process of appeal and counter-appeal, and he said all of this needs to be backed up and moved along and given a sense of urgency, given a sense of meaning by protest and by creative action. And I think we need to think about that much more deeply and create a much more nuanced and thoughtful critique, not just of the war on terror, war in Iraq, and bring the troops home now, but what does it mean to live in the age of terror? What does it mean to be a citizen of a country at war against this shadowy non-entity, this boogeyman, really, and how do we nonviolently and conscientiously create some alternatives to all of that?
We're at war with a noun, or is it an adjective? I'm not sure which. Well, finally, I was wondering if you could briefly comment, and this might be a tough question, but you come from a long tradition, both historically and in terms of family lines, of nonviolent resistance. And I think it's, you know, there are so many different groups out there with so many different strategies, and some are militant and some are who knows. Can you talk about how important nonviolence is to not only your work, but to social transformation?
Yeah. Oh, no, that's an easy question, Jarrett. No, that is hard, but I think it's really about hope, right? And it's about living right now through our decisions and our actions in the world that we want to see, which is a world based on trust and relationship and a sense of interdependence. And all those are such anti-American concepts. And they're anti-nation. They're anti-nationalist concepts. But they're really affirming of individual people and of collectives of people. And so I think that nonviolence has this much broader definition than just a set of tactics or a set of rules around how we comport ourselves at a demonstration or an action. But it really embraces living sustainably, being connected and interdependent with other human beings as opposed to dependent on institutions. And it's about constantly creating and recreating and creating again the kind of world that we want our children and grandchildren to live in. And we can't make that manifest on a national and international scene, although we need to be working against illegitimate use of power all the time. But we can make that happen in our relationships with other people. And so it's an organizing principle, it's a philosophy, it's a way of interacting with other people, and it's a way of remaining active and hopeful in the face of just really sort of tough set of situations that we find ourselves in now in the 21st century in the United States, a country of such wealth and privilege and that holds itself as exceptional and unbound by all of these laws. I don't know if that really answers your question.
Yeah,
but
that more than answers the question. The website, thank you so much, is witnessagainsttorture.org. You could find out lots of information, some great blogs, and definitely check in to find out about details as the January 11th International Day to Shut Down Guantanamo approaches. Frida Berrigan, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
I really enjoyed talking with you, Jared.
Thank you, and you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll be back after this break.